Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is God's Gumshoe, and this is an investigation into the New Testament Bible. This is episode 5 of an investigation into the last and final days of Jesus on planet Earth. Today is what most Christians call Good Friday, or Black Friday. It's now Friday morning. Jesus has been seized, and he's been dragged before the Sanhedrin. We'll pick up the story first with our scholastic perspective, and then from our biblical worldview and from the Urantia Papers worldview side by side, we'll begin with this arrest of Jesus as he's taken before Pilate. The biblical world perspective will come from the Bible Heritage Foundation's story of Jesus, and the Urantia Papers will come from papers 185 to 187. Let's have a listen to this final day of Jesus' life here in the flesh on the planet.
Days before his death, Jesus began asking for trouble. And until now, scholars have wondered why. New historical evidence now sheds light on Jesus of Nazareth and the crucial hours before his death. And for the first time, scientists can put a human face on the person more than a billion people around the world believe is the Son of God. Every year, Christians all over the world commemorate the death of Jesus. Here in Jerusalem, pilgrims reenact the last hours when he carried his cross through the streets of the city to the place of his execution. The crucifixion is one of the best attested facts in history. Not only is it mentioned in the Bible more than 80 times, it is also recorded by the first century historian Josephus. But Jesus' actions in the 24 hours before his death remain clouded in mystery. He had many chances to avoid execution, yet he never took them. Quite the contrary. Growing up in Galilee, Jesus knew all about the risks of challenging both the Jewish and Roman establishment. Herod Antipas, the king of the Jews, the temple priests, and Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor, had sent many Jewish rebels to their deaths. Jesus had reason to fear them all. And yet he became convinced that he was the Messiah, the Savior the Jews had been longing for. Right away, Jesus gathered around him 12 disciples and launched a campaign that put him on a collision course, not with the Romans, but with the Jewish authorities. He began to reach out to the outcasts, the people rejected as impure by the religious leaders. He healed the sick. He cured the blind and the lame. He forgave the sins of prostitutes. And he welcomed into the Jewish faith long-standing enemies like the Samaritans and the Gentiles. But all that was in the safety of Galilee. And one day, Jesus decided to come to Jerusalem and confront those responsible directly. That meant standing up to the high priests, the aristocratic elite who restricted access to the temple. Instead of walking, he rode into the city through the east gate, just as the prophecy in the book of Zechariah said the Messiah would. Then he went into the temple where the money changers were. It was a protest against all the injustices the temple system stood for. But it was hardly going to bring it down.
Obviously, many, many people in the temple would have been very proud of what he did. Probably some of them would have been soldiers that were guarding the temple. Certainly, none of the priests, none of the soldiers in the temple did anything at that time to stop him. What is in Jesus' mind? Why does he turn around now and walk out? What is going on, Jesus?
That night was the eve of the holiest day in Judaism, Passover. Missing another chance to escape, Jesus invited his disciples to celebrate the holiday. Passover was an uneasy time for both the Romans and the temple priests, for it commemorated the flight of the Hebrews from Egypt. It was an occasion when Jewish thoughts inevitably turned to freedom from oppression and injustice. But the disciples couldn't have guessed that this was to be their last supper together. The meal was held in the guest room of a well-to-do house in Jerusalem. The Last Supper is an iconic scene in Christianity, but the historical evidence showed that it would have looked very different to the familiar image immortalized by Leonardo da Vinci. In every detail, how they sat, where they sat, da Vinci got it wrong. In this museum in Jerusalem, curators have recreated a typical Passover meal in a guest room, as described in the writings of Josephus.
Historical sources tell us that important meals would be eaten around three-sided tables, pretty much like this one we have here, with mattresses and pillows. Josephus also points out that the left side of the table, not the center of the table, is the most important position. So let's place Jesus here on this left side where I'm seated. And at that time, then you'll be reclining to eat your meals. I know that doesn't sound very comfortable today, but would be back then. And you eat from the table.
The Gospels back up the idea of a triclinium. John's Gospel says that the beloved disciple reclined his head on the Master's chest. It was the only way he could have comfortably spoken to Jesus. Hananiah Pinto believes it's also possible to tell where some of the other disciples were sat.
The same gospel tells us that Judas probably was to the left of Jesus because he's dipping his food on Jesus' bowl.
It was meant to be a festive meal. Instead, Jesus startled his disciples. He said that one of them would betray him. Before the disciples had taken in the news, Jesus made a cryptic remark. He told Judas to go and do what he has to do. The listener or reader of this story is meant to think that Judas was the traitor. But that's not necessarily how the disciples would have seen it. The Gospel of Matthew says that Judas was the only disciple Jesus called his friend. In fact, a careful reading of the Gospel shows that none of the disciples suspected Judas.
When Judas leaves during the Last Supper, everybody in that room, including the beloved disciple, think there are two options. He's going to give money to the poor so they can celebrate Passover, or he's going to make preparation for the Passover for Jesus' group. In any case, everybody in the room thinks he's doing Jesus' will. What is going on?
The disciples would soon find out. After supper, the group, minus Judas, made their way home. Being Passover night, Roman soldiers and temple guards may well have been on patrol, some of them perhaps even looking out for Jesus. On the way home to their lodgings in a nearby town called Bethany, they stopped for a rest in a garden called Gethsemane on the Mount of Olives overlooking the city. Though the disciples soon fell asleep, Jesus was still up and about. Luke's gospel portrays Jesus that night as a man in crisis, agonizing over what to do next. In his anguish, writes Luke, his sweat fell to the ground like great drops of blood. This evocative image is sometimes regarded as a figure of speech, but evidence shows that it may have been a very real experience, giving us a glimpse into Jesus' state of mind. The forensic evidence strongly suggests that Jesus was in anguish because he knew that the end was near. It was nearly dawn, and Judas wasn't back yet. When Jesus returned to the disciples, he scolded them for not keeping guard. Then suddenly Judas appeared with some temple guards. They had come to arrest Jesus. The Gospels point the finger at Judas. After all, they say, he admits he was paid 30 pieces of silver by the priests. Jesus had time to escape. Just beyond the crest of the Mount of Olives was the desert, where he'd have been safe. But he stayed put. It seemed like madness, but it brought Jesus closer to his goal, a confrontation with the chief priest of the temple, Caiaphas. After the king, Caiaphas was the most important figure in the Jewish establishment. He had the final say over who was and wasn't entitled to enter the temple. Like modern Jerusalem at festival time, the city would have been heaving with pilgrims, soldiers on red alert. According to historians, the last thing Caiaphas wanted was a riot on his hands. He would have to act decisively.
Caiaphas probably genuinely believed that Jesus was a troublemaker, genuinely believed that he was a false prophet who was leading the people astray, and genuinely thought that he should be got rid of.
Caiaphas wasn't the only official worried about security that week. The chief priest was ultimately answerable to Pontius Pilate, the ruthless Roman governor. Jesus wasn't the only rebel to cross his path.
There was actually another messianic pretender in the time of Pilate. This man was a Samaritan. He claimed to be the Samaritan Messiah, or Taheb as he was known, and he gathered a large crowd of people to the foot of a mountain called Mount Gerizim. Pilate heard about this. He heard that there was a great number of people all gathering in this small town, and that the people actually had weapons with them. So he sent in the cavalry, who executed lots of them and captured others. Jesus was just a provincial. It wasn't worth it to allow a provincial to carry on and possibly incite a rebellion, which then would have got to Rome and it would have looked bad on Pilate. It's much easier just to get rid of him straight away.
But as Jesus was being led to meet Caiaphas, the chief priest would have known that Jesus was a popular figure. He would need a crime he could sell to the people, preferably a confession. The Gospels contain revealing glimpses into the exchanges that took place between Jesus and Caiaphas. The chief priest accused Jesus of acting like a Messiah and a new king of the Jews. Both were charges that would make Jesus a criminal in the eyes of the Romans. Jesus could hardly deny the charge, but he hurt his case by adding that Caiaphas would see him exalted on the clouds of heaven, sitting on the right hand of God. Outraged, Caiaphas accused Jesus of blasphemy. In the Jewish faith, no one not even the Messiah could be identified so closely with God.
Caiaphas, as a result of this answer, has got two things that he wanted. On the one hand, he can easily now hand Jesus over to the Roman authorities and say, he thinks he's the king of the Jews, you know what to do next, and the Romans did. On the other hand, Caiaphas can put it out among the Jewish populace that Jesus is a blasphemer, and therefore, under Jewish law, he deserves to die.
Jesus must have foreseen that his action might cost his life.
Most of the prophets pay the great price. Jeremiah is stoned. Isaiah is sawed in two. Who was his teacher? John the Baptist. He's beheaded. Who was the great miracle worker just before him? Honi. He was stoned just outside of Jerusalem, not far from here.
Stoning is probably what the priests had in mind for Jesus. Scholars believe it's unlikely that they would have expected him to be crucified.
If there were priests that turned him over to Pilate, they may have in their mind, let's get this great man, this one is a trouble rouser, this one that has problems, gathers crowds, let us put him with the Roman authorities for a day or two. I don't think the high priest thought that he might be crucified. Would a Jew who was religious want that happen to another man who's religious?
Jesus' last hours are remembered every year by Christians all over the world.
So there we have the scholastic perspective, and we'd like to thank the people at Faith Reason website for this presentation. Now we move on to the sentencing, the arrest and sentencing of Jesus before Pilate, and we do so from the biblical perspective as well as from the Urench papers perspective. From the biblical perspective, we begin with the story of Jesus from the Bible Heritage Foundation, and we follow that up from paper 185, section 5 of the Urench papers, a side-by-side comparison, if you like, of these events as they unfolded. Let's have a listen.
Chapter 142, Pilate sentences Jesus. Now it was the custom that at the feast of the Passover that the authorities would release a prisoner. And there was one notable prisoner, a murderer and a rebel against Rome. His name was Barabbas. And the multitude went up to Pilate and began demanding their annual gift of a released prisoner. Pilate saw this as an opportunity to escape his difficulties over Jesus. And when they had gathered together, Pilate asked them, "Would you like me to release Jesus, the King of the Jews? I have examined him, and I can find no fault in him. Herod cannot find anything wrong with him either. According to your custom, I will chastise Jesus and then release him. Or I can release Barabbas. Which would you like me to release to you? Barabbas, a murderer and a rebel, or Jesus?" And they cried out all together, saying, "Away with this man! Release Barabbas!" As Pilate was sitting in the judgment seat, a message came from his wife. The message said, "I have had terrible dreams regarding this man Jesus. You must release him and have nothing further to do with him." The chief priests and the elders stirred up the multitude that they should demand the release of Barabbas and destroy Jesus. They cried out, saying, "Not this man, but Barabbas." Pilate spoke to them again, trying to persuade them that he should release Jesus. The crowds would hear none of it, and began shouting, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" And they all said, "Let him be crucified." Pilate tried the third time, asking them, "What evil has this man done? I can find nothing in him that deserves death. I will chastise him and release him." But the crowds became even more agitated, saying, "Crucify him! Let him be crucified!" Then Pilate took Jesus and scourged him, and the soldiers forced a crown of thorns on his head and put a purple robe around his neck. They came to him and said, "Hail, King of the Jews," and they struck him with their hands. Pilate hoped that the crowd would be satisfied with this humiliation and punishment of Jesus and had him brought up in front of the people wearing a crown of thorns and a purple robe. Pilate said to them, "Behold the man!" When the chief priest and officers saw him, they cried out, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" Pilate said, "Take him and crucify him yourself, for I can find no crime in him." The Jews answered, "We have a law that he should die, because he made himself out to be the Son of God." When Pilate heard this, he was even more afraid and went into the praetorium, again taking Jesus with him. He questioned Jesus, "Where did you come from?" But Jesus did not give him an answer. Pilate said to him, "Don't you know that I have the power to release you or to crucify you?" Jesus answered, "You would have no power against me, except it was given to you from above. Therefore, he that delivered me up to you has the greater sin." Hearing this, Pilate began to seek even harder to try and release Jesus. But the Jews cried out, saying, "If you release him, then you are no friend of Caesar's. Everyone that makes himself a king is in opposition to Caesar." When Pilate heard these words, he brought Jesus out and sat him down on the judgment seat at the place called the pavement. In Hebrew, it is called Gabbatha. It was the preparation for the Passover, about the sixth hour. And he said to the Jews, "Behold your king." And they cried, "Away with him, away with him, crucify him." Pilate asked, "Shall I crucify your king?" The chief priests cried out, "We have no king but Caesar." Finally, Pilate gave up, since the harder he tried to release Jesus, the more agitated the crowds became in their determination to have Christ crucified. Pilate took water and washed his hands before the people. He said, "I am innocent of the blood of this righteous man." And the people answered and said, "His blood is on us and on our children." Pilate then released Barabbas and turned Jesus over to their purposes to be crucified. The soldiers of Pilate led Jesus away to the praetorium court, where they gathered other soldiers. And when they had gathered a band of soldiers together, they stripped Jesus and clothed him in purple robes. And again they platted a thorn of crowns on his head and began mocking him. They kneeled down to him and saluted him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they spat on him and struck his head with a stick and bowed their knees as if they were worshiping him.
5. Jesus returns to Pilate. When the guards had brought Jesus back to Pilate, he went out on the front steps of the praetorium where his judgment seat had been placed, and calling together the chief priests and Sanhedrists, said to them, "You brought this man before me with charges that he perverts the people, forbids the payment of taxes, and claims to be king of the Jews. I have examined him and fail to find him guilty of these charges. In fact, I find no fault in him. Then I sent him to Herod, and the Tetrarch must have reached the same conclusion, since he has sent him back to us. Certainly, nothing worthy of death has been done by this man. If you still think he needs to be disciplined, I am willing to chastise him before I release him." Just as the Jews were about to engage in shouting their protests against the release of Jesus, a vast crowd came marching up to the praetorium for the purpose of asking Pilate for the release of a prisoner in honor of the Passover feast. For some time it had been the custom of the Roman governors to allow the populace to choose some imprisoned or condemned man for pardon at the time of the Passover. And now that this crowd had come before him to ask for the release of a prisoner, and since Jesus had so recently been in great favor with the multitudes, it occurred to Pilate that he might possibly extricate himself from his predicament by proposing to this group that, since Jesus was now a prisoner before his judgment seat, he released to them this man of Galilee as the token of Passover goodwill. As the crowd surged up on the steps of the building, Pilate heard them calling out the name of one Barabbas. Barabbas was a noted political agitator and murderous robber, the son of a priest, who had recently been apprehended in the act of robbery and murder on the Jericho Road. This man was under sentence to die as soon as the Passover festivities were over. Pilate stood up and explained to the crowd that Jesus had been brought to him by the chief priests, who sought to have him put to death on certain charges, and that he did not think the man was worthy of death. Said Pilate, "Which, therefore, would you prefer that I release to you, this Barabbas, the murderer, or this Jesus of Galilee?" And when Pilate had thus spoken, the chief priests and the Sanhedrin counselors all shouted at the top of their voices, "Barabbas, Barabbas!" And when the people saw that the chief priests were minded to have Jesus put to death, they quickly joined in the clamor for his life, while they loudly shouted for the release of Barabbas. A few days before, this multitude had stood in awe of Jesus, but the mob did not look up to one who, having claimed to be the Son of God, now found himself in the custody of the chief priests and the rulers and on trial before Pilate for his life. Jesus could be a hero in the eyes of the populace when he was driving the money changers and the traders out of the temple, but not when he was a non-resisting prisoner in the hands of his enemies and on trial for his life. Pilate was angered at the sight of the chief priests clamoring for the pardon of a notorious murderer while they shouted for the blood of Jesus. He saw their malice and hatred and perceived their prejudice and envy. Therefore he said to them, "How could you choose the life of a murderer in preference to this man's, whose worst crime is that he figuratively calls himself the King of the Jews?" But this was not a wise statement for Pilate to make. The Jews were a proud people, now subject to the Roman political yoke, but hoping for the coming of a Messiah who would deliver them from Gentile bondage with a great show of power and glory. They resented more than Pilate could know the intimation that this meek-mannered teacher of strange doctrines, now under arrest and charged with crimes worthy of death, should be referred to as the King of the Jews. They looked upon such a remark as an insult to everything which they held sacred and honorable in their national existence, and therefore did they all let loose their mighty shouts for Barabbas' release and Jesus' death. Pilate knew Jesus was innocent of the charges brought against him, and had he been a just and courageous judge, he would have acquitted him and turned him loose. But he was afraid to defy these angry Jews, and while he hesitated to do his duty, a messenger came up and presented him with a sealed message from his wife Claudia. Pilate indicated to those assembled before him that he wished to read the communication which he had just received before he proceeded further with the matter before him. When Pilate opened this letter from his wife, he read, "I pray you have nothing to do with this innocent and just man whom they call Jesus. I have suffered many things in a dream this night because of him." This note from Claudia not only greatly upset Pilate and thereby delayed the adjudication of this matter, but it unfortunately also provided considerable time in which the Jewish rulers freely circulated among the crowd and urged the people to call for the release of Barabbas and to clamor for the crucifixion of Jesus. Finally, Pilate addressed himself once more to the solution of the problem which confronted him by asking the mixed assembly of Jewish rulers and the pardon-seeking crowd, "What shall I do with him who is called the King of the Jews?" And they all shouted with one accord, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" The unanimity of this demand from the mixed multitude startled and alarmed Pilate, the unjust and fear-ridden judge. Then once more Pilate said, "Why would you crucify this man? What evil has he done? Who will come forward to testify against him?" But when they heard Pilate speak in defense of Jesus, they only cried out all the more, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" Then again Pilate appealed to them regarding the release of the Passover prisoner, saying, "Once more I ask you, which of these prisoners shall I release to you at this your Passover time?" And again the crowd shouted, "Give us Barabbas." Then said Pilate, "If I release the murderer Barabbas, what shall I do with Jesus?" And once more the multitude shouted in unison, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" Pilate was terrorized by the insistent clamor of the mob, acting under the direct leadership of the chief priests and the counselors of the Sanhedrin. Nevertheless, he decided upon at least one more attempt to appease the crowd and save Jesus. 6. Pilate's Last Appeal. In all that is transpiring early this Friday morning before Pilate, only the enemies of Jesus are participating. His many friends either do not yet know of his night arrest and early morning trial, or are in hiding lest they also be apprehended and adjudged worthy of death because they believe Jesus' teachings. In the multitude which now clamors for the Master's death are to be found only his sworn enemies and the easily led and unthinking populace. Pilate would make one last appeal to their pity. Being afraid to defy the clamor of this misled mob who cried for the blood of Jesus, he ordered the Jewish guards and the Roman soldiers to take Jesus and scourge him. This was in itself an unjust and illegal procedure, since the Roman law provided that only those condemned to die by crucifixion should be thus subjected to scourging. The guards took Jesus into the open courtyard of the praetorium for this ordeal. Though his enemies did not witness the scourging, Pilate did. And before they had finished this wicked abuse, he directed the scourgers to desist and indicated that Jesus should be brought to him. Before the scourgers laid their knotted whips upon Jesus as he was bound to the whipping post, they again put upon him the purple robe, and plaiting a crown of thorns, they placed it upon his brow. And when they had put a reed in his hand as a mock scepter, they knelt before him and mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they spit upon him and struck him in the face with their hands. and one of them, before they returned him to Pilate, took the reed from his hand and struck him upon the head. Then Pilate led forth this bleeding and lacerated prisoner, and, presenting him before the mixed multitude, said, "Behold the man. Again I declare to you that I find no crime in him, and having scourged him, I would release him." There stood Jesus of Nazareth, clothed in an old purple royal robe, with a crown of thorns piercing his kindly brow. His face was blood-stained, and his form bowed down with suffering and grief. But nothing can appeal to the unfeeling hearts of those who are victims of intense emotional hatred and slaves to religious prejudice. This sight sent a mighty shudder through the realms of a vast universe, but it did not touch the hearts of those who had set their minds to effect the destruction of Jesus. When they had recovered from the first shock of seeing the Master's plight, they only shouted the louder and the longer, "Crucify him! Crucify him! Crucify him!" And now did Pilate comprehend that it was futile to appeal to their supposed feelings of pity. He stepped forward and said, "I perceive that you are determined this man shall die. But what has he done to deserve death? Who will declare his crime?" Then the high priest himself stepped forward and, going up to Pilate, angrily declared, "We have a sacred law, and by that law this man ought to die because he made himself out to be the Son of God." When Pilate heard this, he was all the more afraid, not only of the Jews, but recalling his wife's note and the Greek mythology of the gods coming down on earth, he now trembled at the thought of Jesus possibly being a divine personage. He waved to the crowd to hold its peace, while he took Jesus by the arm and again led him inside the building, that he might further examine him. Pilate was now confused by fear, bewildered by superstition, and harassed by the stubborn attitude of the mob. 7. Pilate's last interview. As Pilate, trembling with fearful emotion, sat down by the side of Jesus, he inquired, "Where do you come from? Really, who are you? What is this, they say, that you are the Son of God?" But Jesus could hardly answer such questions when asked by a man-fearing, weak, and vacillating judge who was so unjust as to subject him to flogging even when he had declared him innocent of all crime, and before he had been duly sentenced to die. Jesus looked Pilate straight in the face, but he did not answer him. Then said Pilate, "Do you refuse to speak to me? Do you not realize that I still have power to release you or to crucify you?" Then said Jesus, "You could have no power over me except it were permitted from above. You could exercise no authority over the Son of Man unless the Father in heaven allowed it. But you are not so guilty, since you are ignorant of the gospel. He who betrayed me and he who delivered me to you, they have the greater sin." This last talk with Jesus thoroughly frightened Pilate. This moral coward and judicial weakling now labored under the double weight of the superstitious fear of Jesus and mortal dread of the Jewish leaders. Again Pilate appeared before the crowd, saying, "I am certain this man is only a religious offender. You should take him and judge him by your law. Why should you expect that I would consent to his death because he has clashed with your traditions?" Pilate was just about ready to release Jesus when Caiaphas the high priest approached the cowardly Roman judge and, shaking an avenging finger in Pilate's face, said with angry words which the entire multitude could hear, "If you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend, and I will see that the emperor knows all." This public threat was too much for Pilate. Fear for his personal fortunes now eclipsed all other considerations, and the cowardly governor ordered Jesus brought out before the judgment seat. As the Master stood there before them, he pointed to him and tauntingly said, "Behold your king." And the Jews answered, "Away with him! Crucify him!" And then Pilate said, with much irony and sarcasm, "Shall I crucify your king?" And the Jews answered, "Yes, crucify him. We have no king but Caesar." And then did Pilate realize that there was no hope of saving Jesus, since he was unwilling to defy the Jews. 8. Pilate's tragic surrender. Here stood the Son of God incarnate as the Son of Man. He was arrested without indictment, accused without evidence, adjudged without witnesses, punished without a verdict, and now was soon to be condemned to die by an unjust judge who confessed that he could find no fault in him. If Pilate had thought to appeal to their patriotism by referring to Jesus as the King of the Jews, he utterly failed. The Jews were not expecting any such a king. The declaration of the chief priests and the Sadducees, "We have no king but Caesar," was a shock even to the unthinking populace, but it was too late now to save Jesus, even had the mob dared to espouse the Master's cause. Pilate was afraid of a tumult or a riot. He dared not risk having such a disturbance during Passover time in Jerusalem. He had recently received a reprimand from Caesar, and he would not risk another. The mob cheered when he ordered the release of Barabbas. Then he ordered a basin and some water, and there before the multitude he washed his hands, saying, "I am innocent of the blood of this man. You are determined that he shall die, but I have found no guilt in him. See you to it. The soldiers will lead him forth." And then the mob cheered and replied, "His blood be on us and on our children."
Amongst these tragic events, another event was unfolding. And here we hear what became of Judas, the betrayer. First, the biblical perspective, and then from paper 186 of the Urantia Papers, the story of what became of Judas. Let's have a listen.
Chapter 143, Suicide of Judas. Then Judas, who had betrayed Jesus, when he saw that Jesus had been condemned, changed his mind and brought back the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders, saying, "I have sinned in this betrayal of innocent blood." But they said to him, "What does that have to do with us?" Judas cast down the 30 pieces of silver and went away and hanged himself. And then his body fell to the ground and his bowels burst and gushed out. The chief priest took the silver and said, "It is not lawful to put this money into the treasury, since it is blood money." They met together and decided to buy a potter's field in which to bury foreigners. When they did this, they fulfilled the prophecy of Jeremiah that said, "And they took the 30 pieces of silver, the price of him, whom certain of the children of Israel did price, and they bought a potter's field, as the Lord appointed me." And the field became known to all those that lived in Jerusalem as the field of blood.
Paper 186. Just before the crucifixion. As Jesus and his accusers started off to see Herod, the Master turned to the Apostle John and said, "John, you can do no more for me. Go to my mother and bring her to see me ere I die." When John heard his master's request, although reluctant to leave him alone among his enemies, he hastened off to Bethany, where the entire family of Jesus was assembled in waiting at the home of Martha and Mary, the sisters of Lazarus, whom Jesus raised from the dead. Several times during the morning, messengers had brought news to Martha and Mary concerning the progress of Jesus' trial. But the family of Jesus did not reach Bethany until just a few minutes before John arrived, bearing the request of Jesus to see his mother before he was put to death. After John Zebedee had told them all that had happened since the midnight arrest of Jesus, Mary, his mother, went at once in the company of John to see her eldest son. By the time Mary and John reached the city, Jesus, accompanied by the Roman soldiers who were to crucify him, had already arrived at Golgotha. When Mary, the mother of Jesus, started out with John to go to her son, his sister Ruth refused to remain behind with the rest of the family. Since she was determined to accompany her mother, her brother Jude went with her. The rest of the Master's family remained in Bethany under the direction of James, and almost every hour the messengers of David Zebedee brought them reports concerning the progress of that terrible business of putting to death their eldest brother, Jesus of Nazareth. 1. The end of Judas Iscariot. It was about 8:30 this Friday morning when the hearing of Jesus before Pilate was ended and the Master was placed in the custody of the Roman soldiers who were to crucify him. As soon as the Romans took possession of Jesus, the captain of the Jewish guards marched with his men back to their temple headquarters. The chief priest and his Sanhedrist associates followed close behind the guards, going directly to their usual meeting place in the hall of hewn stone in the temple. Here they found many other members of the Sanhedrin waiting to learn what had been done with Jesus. As Caiaphas was engaged in making his report to the Sanhedrin regarding the trial and condemnation of Jesus, Judas appeared before them to claim his reward for the part he had played in his master's arrest and sentence of death. all of these Jews loathed Judas. They looked upon the betrayer with only feelings of utter contempt. Throughout the trial of Jesus before Caiaphas and during his appearance before Pilate, Judas was pricked in his conscience about his traitorous conduct. And he was also beginning to become somewhat disillusioned regarding the reward he was to receive as payment for his services as Jesus' betrayer. He did not like the coolness and aloofness of the Jewish authorities. Nevertheless, he expected to be liberally rewarded for his cowardly conduct. He anticipated being called before the full meeting of the Sanhedrin, and there hearing himself eulogized while they conferred upon him suitable honors in token of the great service which he flattered himself he had rendered his nation. Imagine, therefore, the great surprise of this egotistic traitor when a servant of the high priest, tapping him on the shoulder, called him just outside the hall and said, "Judas, I have been appointed to pay you for the betrayal of Jesus. Here is your reward." And thus speaking, the servant of Caiaphas handed Judas a bag containing 30 pieces of silver, the current price of a good, healthy slave. Judas was stunned, dumbfounded. He rushed back to enter the hall, but was debarred by the doorkeeper. He wanted to appeal to the Sanhedrin, but they would not admit him. Judas could not believe that these rulers of the Jews would allow him to betray his friends and his master and then offer him as a reward 30 pieces of silver. He was humiliated, disillusioned, and utterly crushed. He walked away from the temple, as it were, in a trance. He automatically dropped the money bag in his deep pocket, that same pocket wherein he had so long carried the bag containing the apostolic funds. And he wandered out through the city after the crowds who were on their way to witness the crucifixion. From a distance, Judas saw them raise the crosspiece with Jesus nailed thereon. And upon sight of this, he rushed back to the temple and, forcing his way past the doorkeeper, found himself standing in the presence of the Sanhedrin, which was still in session. The betrayer was well nigh breathless and highly distraught, but he managed to stammer out these words, "I have sinned in that I have betrayed innocent blood. You have insulted me. You have offered me as a reward for my service money, the price of a slave. I repent that I have done this. Here is your money. I want to escape the guilt of this deed." When the rulers of the Jews heard Judas, they scoffed at him. One of them, sitting near where Judas stood, motioned that he should leave the hall and said, "Your master has already been put to death by the Romans, and as for your guilt, what is that to us? See you to that, and be gone." As Judas left the Sanhedrin chamber, he removed the 30 pieces of silver from the bag and threw them broadcast over the temple floor. When the betrayer left the temple, he was almost beside himself. Judas was now passing through the experience of the realization of the true nature of sin. All the glamour, fascination, and intoxication of wrongdoing had vanished. Now the evildoer stood alone and face to face with the judgment verdict of his disillusioned and disappointed soul. Sin was bewitching and adventurous in the committing. But now must the harvest of the naked and unromantic facts be faced. This one-time ambassador of the kingdom of heaven on earth now walked through the streets of Jerusalem, forsaken and alone. His despair was desperate and well-nigh absolute. On he journeyed through the city and outside the wall, on down into the terrible solitude of the valley of Hinnom, where he climbed up the steep rock and, taking the girdle of his cloak, fastened one end to a small tree, tied the other about his neck, and cast himself over the precipice. Ere he was dead, the knot which his nervous hands had tied gave way, and the betrayer's body was dashed to pieces as it fell on the jagged rocks below. 2. The Master's Attitude. When Jesus was arrested, he knew that his work on earth in the likeness of mortal flesh was finished. He fully understood the sort of death he would die, and he was little concerned with the details of his so-called trial. Before the Sanhedrist court, Jesus declined to make replies to the testimony of perjured witnesses. There was but one question which would always elicit an answer, whether asked by friend or foe, and that was the one concerning the nature and divinity of his mission on earth. When asked if he were the Son of God, he unfailingly made reply, he steadfastly refused to speak when in the presence of the curious and wicked Herod. Before Pilate, he spoke only when he thought that Pilate or some other sincere person might be helped to a better knowledge of the truth by what he said. Jesus had taught his apostles the uselessness of casting their pearls before swine, and he now dared to practice what he had taught. His conduct at this time exemplified the patient submission of the human nature, coupled with the majestic silence and solemn dignity of the divine nature. He was altogether willing to discuss with Pilate any question related to the political charges brought against him, any question which he recognized as belonging to the governor's jurisdiction. Jesus was convinced that it was the will of the Father that he submit himself to the natural and ordinary course of human events, just as every other mortal creature must, and therefore he refused to employ even his purely human powers of persuasive eloquence to influence the outcome of the machinations of his socially nearsighted and spiritually blinded fellow mortals. Although Jesus lived and died on Urantia, his whole human career, from first to last, was a spectacle designed to influence and instruct the entire universe of his creation and unceasing upholding. These short-sighted Jews clamored unseemlily for the Master's death while he stood there in awful silence, looking upon the death scene of a nation, his earthly father's own people. Jesus had acquired that type of human character which could preserve its composure and assert its dignity in the face of continued and gratuitous insult. He could not be intimidated. When first assaulted by the servant of Annas, he had only suggested the propriety of calling witnesses who might duly testify against him. From first to last, in his so-called trial before Pilate, the onlooking celestial hosts could not refrain from broadcasting to the universe the depiction of the scene of Pilate on trial before Jesus. When before Caiaphas, and when all the perjured testimony had broken down, Jesus did not hesitate to answer the question of the chief priest, thereby providing in his own testimony that which they desired as a basis for convicting him of blasphemy. The Master never displayed the least interest in Pilate's well-meant but half-hearted efforts to effect his release. He really pitied Pilate and sincerely endeavored to enlighten his darkened mind. He was wholly passive to all the Roman governor's appeals to the Jews to withdraw their criminal charges against him. Throughout the whole sorrowful ordeal, he bore himself with simple dignity and unostentatious majesty. He would not so much as cast reflections of insincerity upon his would-be murderers when they asked if he were King of the Jews. With but little qualifying explanation, he accepted the designation, knowing that while they had chosen to reject him, he would be the last to afford them real national leadership, even in a spiritual sense. Jesus said little during these trials, but he said enough to show all mortals the kind of human character man can perfect in partnership with God, and to reveal to all the universe the manner in which God can become manifest in the life of the creature when such a creature truly chooses to do the will of the Father, thus becoming an active son of the living God. His love for ignorant mortals is fully disclosed by his patience and great self-possession in the face of the jeers, blows, and buffetings of the coarse soldiers and the unthinking servants. He was not even angry when they blindfolded him and, derisively striking him in the face, exclaimed, "Prophesy to us who it was that struck you." Pilate spoke more truly than he knew when, after Jesus had been scourged, he presented him before the multitude, exclaiming, "Behold the man!" Indeed, the fear-ridden Roman governor little dreamed that at just that moment the universe stood at attention, gazing upon this unique scene of its beloved sovereign thus subjected in humiliation to the taunts and blows of his darkened and degraded mortal subject. And as Pilate spoke, there echoed throughout all Nebadon, "Behold God and man!" Throughout a universe, untold millions have ever since that day continued to behold that man, while the God of Havona, the supreme ruler of the universe of universes, accepts the man of Nazareth as the satisfaction of the ideal of the mortal creatures of this local universe of time and space. In his matchless life, he never failed to reveal God to man. Now, in these final episodes of his mortal career and in his subsequent death, he made a new and touching revelation of man to God. 3. The dependable David Zebedee. Shortly after Jesus was turned over to the Roman soldiers at the conclusion of the hearing before Pilate, a detachment of the temple guards hastened out to Gethsemane to disperse or arrest the followers of the Master. But long before their arrival, these followers had scattered. The apostles had retired to designated hiding places. The Greeks had separated and gone to various homes in Jerusalem. The other disciples had likewise disappeared. David Zebedee believed that Jesus' enemies would return, so he early removed some 5 or 6 tents up the ravine near where the Master so often retired to pray and worship. Here he proposed to hide and at the same time maintain a center or coordinating station for his messenger service. David had hardly left the camp when the temple guards arrived. Finding no one there, they contented themselves with burning the camp and then hastened back to the temple. On hearing their report, the Sanhedrin was satisfied that the followers of Jesus were so thoroughly frightened and subdued that there would be no danger of an uprising or any attempt to rescue Jesus from the hands of his executioners. They were at last able to breathe easily, and so they adjourned, every man going his way to prepare for the Passover. As soon as Jesus was turned over to the Roman soldiers by Pilate for crucifixion, a messenger hastened away to Gethsemane to inform David, and within 5 minutes, runners were on their way to Bethsaida, Hela, Philadelphia, Sidon, Shechem, Hebron, Damascus, and Alexandria. And these messengers carried the news that Jesus was about to be crucified by the Romans at the insistent behest of the rulers of the Jews. Throughout this tragic day, until the message finally went forth that the Master had been laid in the tomb, David sent messengers about every half hour with reports to the apostles, the Greeks, and Jesus' earthly family assembled at the home of Lazarus in Bethany. When the messengers departed with the word that Jesus had been buried, David dismissed his corps of local runners for the Passover celebration and for the coming Sabbath of rest, instructing them to report to him quietly on Sunday morning at the home of Nicodemus, where he proposed to go in hiding for a few days with Andrew and Simon Peter. This peculiar-minded David Zebedee was the only one of the leading disciples of Jesus who was inclined to take a literal and plain matter-of-fact view of the Master's assertion that he would die and rise again on the third day. David had once heard him make this prediction, and being of a literal turn of mind, now proposed to assemble his messengers early Sunday morning at the home of Nicodemus, so that they would be on hand to spread the news in case Jesus rose from the dead. David soon discovered that none of Jesus' followers were looking for him to return so soon from the grave. Therefore did he say little about his belief, and nothing about the mobilization of all his messenger force on early Sunday morning, except the runners who had been dispatched on Friday forenoon to distant cities and believer centers. And so these followers of Jesus, scattered throughout Jerusalem and its environs, that night partook of the Passover, and the following day remained in seclusion. 4. Preparation for the crucifixion. After Pilate had washed his hands before the multitude, thus seeking to escape the guilt of delivering up an innocent man to be crucified, just because he feared to resist the clamor of the rulers of the Jews, he ordered the Master turned over to the Roman soldiers and gave the word to their captain that he was to be crucified immediately. Upon taking charge of Jesus, the soldiers led him back into the courtyard of the Praetorium, and after removing the robe which Herod had put on him, they dressed him in his own garments. These soldiers mocked and derided him. They did not inflict further physical punishment. Jesus was now alone with these Roman soldiers. His friends were in hiding. His enemies had gone their way. Even John Zebedee was no longer by his side. It was a little after 8 o'clock when Pilate turned Jesus over to the soldiers, and a little before 9 o'clock when they started for the scene of the crucifixion. During this period of more than half an hour, Jesus never spoke a word. The executive business of a great universe was practically at a standstill. Gabriel and the chief rulers of Nebadon were either assembled here on Urantia or else they were closely attending upon the space reports of the archangel in an effort to keep advised as to what was happening to the Son of Man on Urantia. By the time the soldiers were ready to depart with Jesus for Golgotha, they had begun to be impressed by his unusual composure and extraordinary dignity, by his uncomplaining silence. Much of the delay in starting off with Jesus for the site of the crucifixion was due to the last-minute decision of the captain to take along two thieves who had been condemned to die. Since Jesus was to be crucified that morning, the Roman captain thought these two might just as well die with him as wait for the end of the Passover festivities. As soon as the thieves could be made ready, they were led into the courtyard, where they gazed upon Jesus, one of them, for the first time, but the other had often heard him speak, both in the temple and many months before at the Pella camp. 5. Jesus' death in relation to the Passover. There is no direct relation between the death of Jesus and the Jewish Passover. True, the Master did lay down his life in the flesh on this day, the day of the preparation for the Jewish Passover, and at about the time of the sacrificing of the Passover lambs in the temple. But this coincidental occurrence does not in any manner indicate that the death of the Son of Man on earth has any connection with the Jewish sacrificial system. Jesus was a Jew, but as the Son of Man, he was a mortal of the realms. The events already narrated and leading up to this hour of the Master's impending crucifixion are sufficient to indicate that his death at about this time was a purely natural and man-managed affair. It was man and not God who planned and executed the death of Jesus on the cross. True, the Father refused to interfere with the march of human events on Urantia, but the Father in Paradise did not decree, demand, or require the death of his Son as it was carried out on earth. It is a fact that in some manner, sooner or later, Jesus would have had to divest himself of his mortal body, his incarnation in the flesh. But he could have executed such a task in countless ways without dying on a cross between two thieves. All of this was man's doing, not God. At the time of the Master's baptism, he had already completed the technique of the required experience on earth and in the flesh, which was necessary for the completion of his seventh and last universe bestowal. At this very time, Jesus' duty on earth was done. All the life he lived thereafter, and even the manner of his death, was a purely personal ministry on his part for the welfare and uplifting of his mortal creatures on this world and on other worlds. The gospel of the good news that mortal man may, by faith, become spirit conscious that he is a son of God is not dependent on the death of Jesus. True, indeed, all this gospel of the kingdom has been tremendously illuminated by the Master's death, but even more so by his life. All that the Son of Man said or did on earth greatly embellished the doctrines of sonship with God and of the brotherhood of men. But these essential relationships of God and men are inherent in the universe facts of God's love for his creatures and the innate mercy of the divine Son. These touching and divinely beautiful relations between man and his Maker on this world and on all others throughout the universe of universes have existed from eternity. And they are not in any sense dependent on these periodic bestowal enactments of the Creator's sons of God, who thus assume the nature and likeness of their created intelligences as a part of the price which they must pay for the final acquirement of unlimited sovereignty over their respective local universes. The Father in heaven loved mortal man on earth just as much before the life and death of Jesus on Urantia as he did after this transcendent exhibition of the co-partnership of man and God. This mighty transaction of the incarnation of the God of Nebadon as a man on Urantia could not augment the attributes of the eternal, infinite, and universal Father, but it did enrich and enlighten all other administrators and creatures of the universe of Nebadon. While the Father in heaven loves us no more because of this bestowal of Michael, all other celestial intelligences do. And this is because Jesus not only made a revelation of God to man, but he also likewise made a new revelation of man to the gods and to the celestial intelligences of the universe of universes. Jesus is not about to die as a sacrifice for sin. He is not going to atone for the inborn moral guilt of the human race. Mankind has no such racial guilt before God. Guilt is purely a matter of personal sin and knowing deliberate rebellion against the will of the Father and the administration of His Son. Sin and rebellion have nothing to do with the fundamental bestowal plan of the Paradise Sons of God, albeit it does appear to us that the salvage plan is a provisional feature of the bestowal plan. The salvation of God for the mortals of Urantia would have been just as effective and unerringly certain if Jesus had not been put to death by the cruel hands of ignorant mortals. If the Master had been favorably received by the mortals of earth and had departed from Urantia by the voluntary relinquishment of his life in the flesh, the fact of the love of God and the mercy of the Son, the fact of sonship with God, would have in no wise been affected. You mortals are the sons of God, and only one thing is required to make such a truth factual in your personal experience, and that is your spirit-born faith.
Paper 187, The Crucifixion. After the two brigands had been made ready, the soldiers, under the direction of a centurion, started for the scene of the crucifixion. The centurion in charge of these 12 soldiers was the same captain who had led forth the Roman soldiers the previous night to arrest Jesus in Gethsemane. It was the Roman custom to assign 4 soldiers for each person to be crucified. The 2 brigands were properly scourged before they were taken out to be crucified, but Jesus was given no further physical punishment. The captain undoubtedly thought he had already been sufficiently scourged, even before his condemnation. The 2 thieves crucified with Jesus were associates of Barabbas, and would later have been put to death with their leader if he had not been released as the Passover pardon of Pilate. Jesus was thus crucified in the place of Barabbas. What Jesus is now about to do, submit to death on the cross, he does of his own free will. In foretelling this experience, he said, "The Father loves and sustains me because I am willing to lay down my life. But I will take it up again. No one takes my life away from me. I lay it down of myself. I have authority to lay it down, and I have authority to take it up. I have received such a commandment from my Father." It was just before 9 o'clock this morning when the soldiers led Jesus from the praetorium on the way to Golgotha. They were followed by many who secretly sympathized with Jesus, but most of this group of 200 or more were either his enemies or curious idlers who merely desired to enjoy the shock of witnessing the crucifixions. Only a few of the Jewish leaders went out to see Jesus die on the cross. Knowing that he had been turned over to the Roman soldiers by Pilate and that he was condemned to die, they busied themselves with their meeting in the temple, whereat they discussed what should be done with his followers.
Chapter 144, The Crucifixion, A, On the Way to the Cross. And after the Roman soldiers had mocked Jesus, and took off his purple robe, and put his own garments back on, they led him out to crucify him. And he went carrying his own cross for himself. And they made their way to the place where Jesus was to be crucified. A Roman soldier found a man named Simon of Cyrene, and compelled him to carry the cross of Jesus. And a great multitude followed, and all the women wailed and lamented. Jesus turned to them and said, "Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me, weep for yourselves and for your children. The day is coming when they will say, 'Blessed are the barren, and the wombs that do not bear children.' Then they will say to the mountains, 'Fall on us,' and to the hills, 'Cover us.' For if they do these things while the tree is green, what will they do when it is dry?" There were 2 others who were criminals being put to death at the same time as Jesus. And they brought them to the place which is called in Hebrew, Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. And when they had come to the place, they offered Jesus wine to drink mingled with gall. When Jesus tasted it, he would not drink it.
One, On the Way to Golgotha. Before leaving the courtyard of the praetorium, the soldiers placed the crossbeam on Jesus' shoulders. It was the custom to compel the condemned man to carry the crossbeam to the site of the crucifixion. Such a condemned man did not carry the whole cross, only the shorter timber. The longer and upright pieces of timber for the three crosses had already been transported to Golgotha and, by the time of the arrival of the soldiers and their prisoners, had been firmly implanted in the ground. According to custom, the captain led the procession, carrying small white boards on which had been written with charcoal the names of the criminals and the nature of the crimes for which they had been condemned. For the two thieves, the centurion had notices which gave their names, underneath which was written the one word, brigand. It was the custom, after the victim had been nailed to the crossbeam and hoisted to his place on the upright timber, to nail this notice to the top of the cross, just above the head of the criminal, that all witnesses might know for what crime the condemned man was being crucified. The legend which the centurion carried to put on the cross of Jesus had been written by Pilate himself in Latin, Greek, and Aramaic, and it read, "Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews." Some of the Jewish authorities who were yet present when Pilate wrote this legend made vigorous protest against calling Jesus the King of the Jews. But Pilate reminded them that such an accusation was part of the charge which led to his condemnation. When the Jews saw they could not prevail upon Pilate to change his mind, they pleaded that at least it be modified to read, "He said, I am the King of the Jews." But Pilate was adamant. He would not alter the writing. To all further supplication, he only replied, "What I have written, I have written." Ordinarily, it was the custom to journey to Golgotha by the longest road in order that a large number of persons might view the condemned criminal. But on this day, they went by the most direct route to the Damascus Gate, which led out of the city to the north, and following this road, they soon arrived at Golgotha, the official crucifixion site of Jerusalem. Beyond Golgotha were the villas of the wealthy, and on the other side of the road were the tombs of many well-to-do Jews. Crucifixion was not a Jewish mode of punishment. Both the Greeks and the Romans learned this method of execution from the Phoenicians. Even Herod, with all his cruelty, did not resort to crucifixion. The Romans never crucified a Roman citizen. Only slaves and subject peoples were subjected to this dishonorable mode of death. During the siege of Jerusalem, just 40 years after the crucifixion of Jesus, all of Golgotha was covered by thousands upon thousands of crosses upon which, from day to day, there perished the flower of the Jewish race. A terrible harvest indeed of the seed-sowing of this day. As the death procession passed along the narrow streets of Jerusalem, many of the tender-hearted Jewish women who had heard Jesus' words of good cheer and compassion, and who knew of his life of loving ministry, could not refrain from weeping when they saw him being led forth to such an ignoble death. As he passed by, many of these women bewailed and lamented. And when some of them even dared to follow along by his side, the Master turned his head toward them and said, "Daughters of Jerusalem, weep not for me, but rather weep for yourselves and for your children. My work is about done. Soon I go to my Father. But the times of terrible trouble for Jerusalem are just beginning. Behold, the days are coming in which you shall say, 'Blessed are the barren, and those whose breasts have never suckled their young.' In those days will you pray the rocks of the hills to fall on you, in order that you may be delivered from the terrors of your troubles." These women of Jerusalem were indeed courageous to manifest sympathy for Jesus, for it was strictly against the law to show friendly feelings for one who was being led forth to crucifixion. It was permitted the rabble to jeer, mock, and ridicule the condemned, but it was not allowed that any sympathy should be expressed. Though Jesus appreciated the manifestation of sympathy in this dark hour when his friends were in hiding, he did not want these kind-hearted women to incur the displeasure of the authorities by daring to show compassion in his behalf. Even at such a time as this, Jesus thought little about himself, only of the terrible days of tragedy ahead for Jerusalem and the whole Jewish nation. As the Master trudged along on the way to the crucifixion, he was very weary. He was nearly exhausted. He had had neither food nor water since the Last Supper at the home of Elijah Mark. Neither had he been permitted to enjoy one moment of sleep. In addition, there had been one hearing right after another up to the hour of his condemnation, not to mention the abusive scourgings with their accompanying physical suffering and loss of blood. Superimposed upon all this was his extreme mental anguish, his acute spiritual tension, and a terrible feeling of human loneliness. Shortly after passing through the gate on the way out of the city, as Jesus staggered on bearing the crossbeam, his physical strength momentarily gave way, and he fell beneath the weight of his heavy burden. The soldiers shouted at him and kicked him, but he could not arise. When the captain saw this, knowing what Jesus had already endured, he commanded the soldiers to desist. Then he ordered a passerby, one Simon from Cyrene, to take the crossbeam from Jesus' shoulders and compelled him to carry it the rest of the way to Golgotha. This man Simon had come all the way from Cyrene in northern Africa to attend the Passover. He was stopping with other Cyrenians just outside the city walls and was on his way to the temple services in the city when the Roman captain commanded him to carry Jesus' crossbeam. Simon lingered all through the hours of the Master's death on the cross, talking with many of his friends and with his enemies. After the resurrection and before leaving Jerusalem, he became a valiant believer in the gospel of the kingdom, and when he returned home, he led his family into the heavenly kingdom. His two sons, Alexander and Rufus, became very effective teachers of the new gospel in Africa. But Simon never knew that Jesus, whose burden he bore, and the Jewish tutor who once befriended his injured son, were the same person. It was shortly after 9 o'clock when this procession of death arrived at Golgotha, and the Roman soldiers set themselves about the task of nailing the two brigands and the Son of Man to their respective crosses.
Chapter 144b, Jesus Crucified. It was the third hour, and they crucified him. There were two others, both robbers and criminals, one on the right side of Jesus and the other on the left. Jesus hung on the cross in the middle. And Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." The soldiers had taken Jesus' garments and divided them between the four of them. When they came to his coat, which was woven from top to bottom and without seams, they said, "Let's not tear this apart, but cast lots to see which one of us will keep it." And when they did this, they fulfilled the scriptures that said, "They parted my garments among them, and upon my vesture did they cast lots." Pilate wrote a title and put it above the cross. It said, "This is Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews." It was written in Hebrew, Latin, and Greek. And all the Jews that were in the city near the place where Jesus was crucified read the title. The chief priests and the Jews of Jerusalem went to Pilate and said, "Do not write, 'He is the King of the Jews,' but write that 'He says he is the King of the Jews.'" Pilate answered, "I have written what I have written." The people stood looking, and as they passed by, they wagged their heads, saying, "Ha, here is the one that is going to destroy the temple and raise it up in 3 days. Save yourself if you are the Son of God, and come down from the cross." In like manner, the chief priests and the officers and the rulers scoffed and mocked him, along with the scribes and the elders, saying, "He saved others, but he cannot save himself. If this is the Christ of God, his chosen, let him come down from the cross, and we will see it and believe on him. He trusted God. Let God deliver him if he wants to. For he said, 'I am the Son of God.'" The soldiers also mocked him, offering him vinegar and saying, "If you are the King of the Jews, save yourself." The robbers that were being crucified with Jesus also reproached him. One of the criminals railed at him, saying, "Are you not the Christ? Save yourself and us." The other robber that was also being crucified with Jesus said to his fellow criminal, "Don't you fear God, seeing that you are under the same condemnation? And we deserve this punishment for the things that we have done. But this man has done nothing wrong." And then he said to Jesus, "Remember me, Lord, when you come to your kingdom." And Jesus said to him, "The truth is that today you will be with me in paradise." The mother of Jesus and her sister, along with Mary and the wife of Clopas and Mary Magdalene, were standing by the cross. When Jesus saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing by, he said to his mother, "Woman, look, your son." And he said to the disciple, "Behold your mother." From that hour on, the disciple took Mary into his home. Chapter 144c, 3 Hours of Darkness. Now it was about the sixth hour when darkness came over the whole land until the ninth hour. About the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, "Eli, Eli, lam sabachthani," which interpreted means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And some that stood by, when they heard it, said, "He is calling for Elijah." After this, knowing that all things were finished, and that the scriptures had been accomplished, said, "I thirst." There was a vessel full of vinegar, and one of them ran and took a sponge and filled it with vinegar, and put it on a hyssop reed, and brought it to his mouth. The rest of those standing around the cross said, "Let's see if Elijah comes to save him." And when Jesus had received the vinegar, Jesus cried again with a loud voice and said, "It is finished. Into your hands I commend my spirit." And having said these words, he bowed his head and gave up his spirit. And immediately the veil in the temple was torn into two pieces, in the middle from the top to bottom. And the earth shook, and rocks cracked in pieces, and the tombs were opened, and many bodies of the saints that had been dead were raised. And they came out of the tombs and walked into Jerusalem and appeared to many. When the centurion, who stood watching Jesus and saw him give up his spirit, and felt and saw the earthquake and all the rest that was done, he was fearful. He glorified God, saying, "Certainly this was a righteous man. This was the Son of God." And all the multitude came together to view the sight of Jesus dead on the cross, went home smiting their breasts in sorrow. And all his acquaintances were at the cross. There were the women that had followed Jesus from Galilee, including Mary Magdalene, and Mary the mother of James and Joseph and Salome, the women that had ministered to Jesus and his disciples.
2. The Crucifixion. The soldiers first bound the master's arms with cords to the crossbeam, and then they nailed his hands to the wood. When they had hoisted this crossbeam up on the post, and after they had nailed it securely to the upright timber of the cross, they bound and nailed his feet to the wood, using one long nail to penetrate both feet. The upright timber had a large peg inserted at the proper height, which served as a sort of saddle for supporting the body weight. The cross was not high, the master's feet being only about 3 feet from the ground. He was, therefore, able to hear all that was said of him in derision, and could plainly see the expression on the faces of all those who so thoughtlessly mocked him. And also could those present easily hear all that Jesus said during these hours of lingering torture and slow death. It was the custom to remove all clothes from those who were to be crucified, but since the Jews greatly objected to the public exposure of the naked human form, the Romans always provided a suitable loincloth for all persons crucified at Jerusalem. Accordingly, after Jesus' clothes had been removed, he was thus garbed before he was put upon the cross. Crucifixion was resorted to in order to provide a cruel and lingering punishment, the victim sometimes not dying for several days. There was considerable sentiment against crucifixion in Jerusalem, and there existed a society of Jewish women who always sent a representative to crucifixions for the purpose of offering drugged wine to the victim in order to lessen his suffering. But when Jesus tasted this narcotized wine, as thirsty as he was, he refused to drink it. The master chose to retain his human consciousness until the very end. He desired to meet death even in this cruel and inhuman form and conquer it by voluntary submission to the full human experience. Before Jesus was put on his cross, the two brigands had already been placed on their crosses, all the while cursing and spitting upon their executioners. Jesus' only words, as they nailed him to the crossbeam, were, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." He could not have so mercifully and lovingly interceded for his executioners if such thoughts of affectionate devotion had not been the mainspring of all his life of unselfish service. The ideas, motives, and longings of a lifetime are openly revealed in a crisis. After the master was hoisted on the cross, the captain nailed the title up above his head, and it read in three languages, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. The Jews were infuriated by this believed insult, but Pilate was chafed by their disrespectful manner. He felt he had been intimidated and humiliated, and he took this method of obtaining petty revenge. He could have written, Jesus, a rebel, but he well knew how these Jerusalem Jews detested the very name of Nazareth, and he was determined thus to humiliate them. He knew that they would also be cut to the very quick by seeing this executed Galilean called the King of the Jews. Many of the Jewish leaders, when they learned how Pilate had sought to deride them by placing this inscription on the cross of Jesus, hastened out to Golgotha, but they dared not attempt to remove it, since the Roman soldiers were standing on guard. Not being able to remove the title, these leaders mingled with the crowd and did their utmost to incite derision and ridicule, lest any give serious regard to the inscription. The Apostle John, with Mary, the mother of Jesus, Ruth, and Jude, arrived on the scene just after Jesus had been hoisted to his position on the cross, and just as the captain was nailing the title above the master's head. John was the only one of the 11 apostles to witness the crucifixion, and even he was not present all of the time, since he ran into Jerusalem to bring back his mother and her friends soon after he had brought Jesus' mother to the scene. As Jesus saw his mother, with John and his brother and sister, he smiled but said nothing. Meanwhile, the four soldiers assigned to the master's crucifixion, as was the custom, had divided his clothes among them, one taking the sandals, one the turban, one the girdle, and the fourth the cloak. This left the tunic, or seamless vestment, running down to near the knees, to be cut up into four pieces. But when the soldiers saw what an unusual garment it was, they decided to cast lots for it. Jesus looked down on them while they divided his garments, and the thoughtless crowd jeered at him. It was well that the Roman soldiers took possession of the master's clothing. Otherwise, if his followers had gained possession of these garments, they would have been tempted to resort to superstitious relic worship. The master desired that his followers should have nothing material to associate with his life on earth. He wanted to leave mankind only the memory of a human life dedicated to the high spiritual ideal of being consecrated to doing the Father's will. 3. Those who saw the crucifixion. At about 9:30 this Friday morning, Jesus was hung upon the cross. Before 11:00, upward of 1,000 persons had assembled to witness the spectacle of the crucifixion of the Son of Man. Throughout these dreadful hours, the unseen hosts of a universe stood in silence while they gazed upon this extraordinary phenomenon of the Creator as he was dying the death of the creature, even the most ignoble death of a condemned criminal. Standing near the cross at one time or another during the crucifixion were Mary, Ruth, Jude, John, Salome, John's mother, and a group of earnest women believers, including Mary, the wife of Clopas, the sister of Jesus' mother, Mary Magdalene, and Rebecca, one time of Sepphoris. These and other friends of Jesus held their peace while they witnessed his great patience and fortitude and gazed upon his intense sufferings. Many who passed by wagged their heads and, railing at him, said, "You who would destroy the temple and build it again in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, why do you not come down from your cross?" In like manner, some of the rulers of the Jews mocked him, saying, "He saved others, but himself he cannot save." Others said, "If you are the King of the Jews, come down from the cross, and we will believe in you." And later on they mocked him the more, saying, "He trusted in God to deliver him. He even claimed to be the Son of God. Look at him now, crucified between two thieves." Even the two thieves also railed at him and cast reproach upon him. Inasmuch as Jesus would make no reply to their taunts, and since it was nearing noontime of this special preparation day, by 11:30 most of the jesting and jeering crowd had gone its way. Less than 50 persons remained on the scene. The soldiers now prepared to eat lunch and drink their cheap, sour wine as they settled down for the long death watch. As they partook of their wine, they derisively offered a toast to Jesus, saying, "Hail and good fortune to the King of the Jews." And they were astonished at the master's tolerant regard of their ridicule and mocking. When Jesus saw them eat and drink, he looked down upon them and said, "I thirst." When the captain of the guard heard Jesus say, "I thirst," he took some of the wine from his bottle, and, putting the saturated sponge stopper upon the end of a javelin, raised it to Jesus so that he could moisten his parched lips. Jesus had purposed to live without resort to his supernatural power, and he likewise elected to die as an ordinary mortal upon the cross. He had lived as a man, and he would die as a man, doing the Father's will.
Chapter 144d, Jesus found to be dead. Because the Sabbath of the Passover week was approaching, and the Jews did not want any bodies hanging on the cross on the Sabbath day, they asked Pilate to break their legs and dispose of the bodies. The soldiers came to break the legs of the first criminal, but when they came to Jesus, they saw that he was already dead, so they did not break his legs. But to be sure that Jesus was dead, they took a spear and pierced his side. Blood and water poured from his wound. This fulfilled the scriptures that said, "Not a bone of his will be broken," and again, "They will look on him whom they pierced." Joseph of Arimathea, who was a rich man and also a good and righteous man, had not consented to what the chief priests and rulers of Israel had done. He was also looking for the kingdom of God and was a secret disciple of Jesus, fearing the Jews. He boldly went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. Pilate was amazed that Jesus was already dead and called the centurion in charge to ask how long Jesus had been dead. After the centurion verified that Jesus was dead and gave him the details of his death, Pilate gave the body to Joseph. Nicodemus, who had come to Jesus by night, had also come to help with the dead body of Jesus. He brought 100 pounds of myrrh and alloys. Joseph brought linen cloth. Joseph took down the body of Jesus and wrapped him in linen cloth with spices, which was the burial custom of the Jews. Now near the place where Jesus was crucified there was a garden, and in that garden there was a new tomb that had been hewn out of rock. No one had been buried in this tomb before. They laid Jesus in the tomb and rolled a great stone up against the door of the tomb and left. The women who had come from Galilee followed after Joseph and his party and saw the place where Jesus' body was laid. Mary Magdalene was there and the other Mary. They returned to where they were staying to prepare spices and ointments for the burial, but they rested on the Sabbath day. The chief priests and Pharisees gathered together and came to Pilate. They said to Pilate, "Sir, we remember that this deceiver, while he was alive, said that he would rise again after 3 days. Command that the tomb be guarded until the third day, so that one of his disciples does not come and steal the body and say to the people that Jesus is risen from the dead, which would make matters worse." Pilate said to them, "I give you a guard, go and make it as secure as you can." So they went and made the sepulcher sure, sealing the stone and posting guards around it.
4. The thief on the cross. One of the brigands railed at Jesus, saying, "If you are the Son of God, why do you not save yourself and us?" But when he had reproached Jesus, the other thief, who had many times heard the master teach, said, "Do you have no fear even of God? Do you not see that we are suffering justly for our deeds, but that this man suffers unjustly? Better that we should seek forgiveness for our sins and salvation for our souls." When Jesus heard the thief say this, he turned his face toward him and smiled approvingly. When the malefactor saw the face of Jesus turned toward him, he mustered up his courage, fanned a flickering flame of his faith, and said, "Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom." And then Jesus said, "Verily, verily, I say to you today, you shall sometime be with me in paradise." The master had time amidst the pangs of mortal death to listen to the faith confession of the believing brigand. When this thief reached out for salvation, he found deliverance. Many times before this, he had been constrained to believe in Jesus, but only in these last hours of consciousness did he turn with a whole heart toward the Master's teaching. When he saw the manner in which Jesus faced death upon the cross, this thief could no longer resist the conviction that this Son of Man was indeed the Son of God. During this episode of the conversion and reception of the thief into the kingdom by Jesus, the Apostle John was absent, having gone into the city to bring his mother and her friends to the scene of the crucifixion. Luke subsequently heard this story from the converted Roman captain of the guard. The Apostle John told about the crucifixion as he remembered the event, 2/3 of a century after its occurrence. The other records were based upon the recital of the Roman centurion on duty who, because of what he saw and heard, subsequently believed in Jesus and entered into the full fellowship of the kingdom of heaven on earth. This young man, the penitent brigand, had been led into a life of violence and wrongdoing by those who extolled such a career of robbery as an effective patriotic protest against political oppression and social injustice. And this sort of teaching, plus the urge for adventure, led many otherwise well-meaning youths to enlist in these daring expeditions of robbery. This young man had looked upon Barabbas as a hero. Now he saw that he had been mistaken. Here on the cross beside him he saw a really great man, a true hero. Here was a hero who fired his zeal and inspired his highest ideas of moral self-respect and quickened all his ideals of courage, manhood, and bravery. In beholding Jesus, there sprang up in his heart an overwhelming sense of love, loyalty, and genuine greatness. And if any other person among the jeering crowd had experienced the birth of faith within his soul and had appealed to the mercy of Jesus, he would have been received with the same loving consideration that was displayed toward the believing brigand. Just after the repentant thief heard the Master's promise that they should sometime meet in paradise, John returned from the city, bringing with him his mother and a company of almost a dozen women believers. John took up his position near Mary, the mother of Jesus, supporting her. Her son Jude stood on the other side. As Jesus looked down upon this scene, it was noontide, and he said to his mother, "Woman, behold your son." And speaking to John, he said, "My son, behold your mother." And then he addressed them both, saying, "I desire that you depart from this place." And so John and Jude led Mary away from Golgotha. John took the mother of Jesus to the place where he tarried in Jerusalem, and then hastened back to the scene of the crucifixion. After the Passover, Mary returned to Bethsaida, where she lived at John's home for the rest of her natural life. Mary did not live quite 1 year after the death of Jesus. After Mary left, the other women withdrew for a short distance and remained in attendance upon Jesus until he expired on the cross, and they were yet standing by when the body of the Master was taken down for burial. 5. Last Hour on the Cross. Although it was early in the season for such a phenomenon, shortly after 12 o'clock the sky darkened by reason of the fine sand in the air. The people of Jerusalem knew that this meant the coming of one of those hot wind sandstorms from the Arabian desert. Before 1 o'clock, the sky was so dark the sun was hid, and the remainder of the crowd hastened back to the city. When the Master gave up his life shortly after this hour, less than 30 people were present, only the 13 Roman soldiers and a group of about 15 believers. These believers were all women, except two, Jude, Jesus' brother, and John Zebedee, who returned to the scene just before the Master expired. Shortly after 1 o'clock, amidst the increasing darkness of the fierce sandstorm, Jesus began to fail in human consciousness. His last words of mercy, forgiveness, and admonition had been spoken. His last wish concerning the care of his mother had been expressed. During this hour of approaching death, the human mind of Jesus resorted to the repetition of many passages in the Hebrew Scriptures, particularly the Psalms. The last conscious thought of the human Jesus was concerned with the repetition in his mind of a portion of the Book of Psalms, now known as the 20th, 21st, and 22nd Psalms. While his lips would often move, he was too weak to utter the words as these passages, which he so well knew by heart, would pass through his mind. Only a few times did those standing by catch some utterance such as, "I know the Lord will save his anointed. Your hand shall find out all my enemies." And, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Jesus did not for one moment entertain the slightest doubt that he had lived in accordance with the Father's will, and he never doubted that he was now laying down his life in the flesh in accordance with his Father's will. He did not feel that the Father had forsaken him. He was merely reciting in his vanishing consciousness many scriptures, among them this 22nd Psalm, which begins with, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And this happened to be one of the three passages which were spoken with sufficient clearness to be heard by those standing by. The last request which the mortal Jesus made of his fellows was about 1:30, when, a second time, he said, "I thirst," and the same captain of the guard again moistened his lips with the same sponge wet in the sour wine, in those days commonly called vinegar. The sandstorm grew in intensity, and the heavens increasingly darkened. Still, the soldiers and the small group of believers stood by. The soldiers crouched near the cross, huddled together to protect themselves from the cutting sand. The mother of John and others watched from a distance, where they were somewhat sheltered by an overhanging rock. When the Master finally breathed his last, there were present at the foot of his cross John Zebedee, his brother Jude, his sister Ruth, Mary Magdalene, and Rebecca, one time of Sepphoris. It was just before 3:00 when Jesus, with a loud voice, cried out, "It is finished. Father, into your hands I commend my spirit." And when he had thus spoken, he bowed his head and gave up the life struggle. When the Roman centurion saw how Jesus died, he smote his breast and said, "This was indeed a righteous man. Truly, he must have been a son of God." And from that hour he began to believe in Jesus. Jesus died royally, as he had lived. He freely admitted his kingship and remained master of the situation throughout the tragic day. He went willingly to his ignominious death, after he had provided for the safety of his chosen apostles. He wisely restrained Peter's troublemaking violence and provided that John might be near him right up to the end of his mortal existence. He revealed his true nature to the murderous Sanhedrin and reminded Pilate of the source of his sovereign authority as a son of God. He started out to Golgotha bearing his own crossbeam and finished up his loving bestowal by handing over his spirit of mortal acquirement to the Paradise Father. After such a life and at such a death, the Master could truly say, "It is finished." Because this was the preparation day for both the Passover and the Sabbath, the Jews did not want these bodies to be exposed on Golgotha. Therefore they went before Pilate, asking that the legs of these three men be broken, and that they be dispatched, so that they could be taken down from their crosses and cast into the criminal burial pits before sundown. When Pilate heard this request, he forthwith sent three soldiers to break the legs and dispatch Jesus and the two brigands. When these soldiers arrived at Golgotha, they did accordingly to the two thieves, but they found Jesus already dead, much to their surprise. However, in order to make sure of his death, one of the soldiers pierced his left side with his spear. Though it was common for the victims of crucifixion to linger alive upon the cross for even 2 or 3 days, the overwhelming emotional agony and the acute spiritual anguish of Jesus brought an end to his mortal life in the flesh in a little less than 5.5 hours. 6. After the crucifixion. In the midst of the darkness of the sandstorm, about 3:30, David Zebedee sent out the last of the messengers carrying the news of the Master's death. The last of his runners he dispatched to the home of Martha and Mary in Bethany, where he supposed the mother of Jesus stopped with the rest of her family. After the death of the Master, John sent the women, in charge of Jude, to the home of Elijah Mark, where they tarried over the Sabbath day. John himself, being well known by this time to the Roman centurion, remained at Golgotha until Joseph and Nicodemus arrived on the scene with an order from Pilate authorizing them to take possession of the body of Jesus. Thus ended a day of tragedy and sorrow for a vast universe whose myriads of intelligences had shuddered at the shocking spectacle of the crucifixion of the human incarnation of their beloved sovereign. They were stunned by this exhibition of mortal callousness and human perversity.
And so there we have the darkest day ever on our planet. But, as my Bible professor used to tell us, if you're ever in a situation where you're about to be crucified, make sure you stick around for the resurrection. Join us next week as we investigate the story of Jesus and the resurrection. We'd like to thank the Bible Heritage Foundation for giving us permission to use the story of Jesus. And we'd like to thank the Urantia Book Fellowship and the Cosmic Citizen. We'd also like to thank Faith Reason for their presentation of the academic perspective. Please join us next week for another episode in the last days of Jesus. We're not finished. Thank you. See you next week.